Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A little change of pace and something new on Research on Religion today. Normally, our podcast program will feature scholars talking about their specific research, be it a recent book or an article they wrote. On some occasions, we'll talk to practitioners in the religious sector of our economy, but there again, we tend to focus specifically on what those practitioners do. Today, I am reaching out to somebody who is an expert in the sociological study of religion, but instead of talking about his research, I thought we'd just talk about some recent themes that have come up here on the podcast and a few other events in the news. And who better to do this with than my good friend and colleague Steve Pfaff, associate professor of sociology at the University of Washington. I am a frequent visitor to Steve's office across the quad here on the UW campus, and we usually get into academic discussions about what we're working on research-wise, but oftentimes a lot of stuff that just happens to come up in the news or in our everyday lives is also discussed. Steve is the author of a number of articles that look into religion, but he has also studied things as varied as mutinies aboard 18th century British ships, to the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 1980s, which he published in the form of an award-winning book entitled Exit Voice Dynamics and the Collapse of East Germany. We'll go ahead and link to that on our website. It's a great book, and if you're interested in that topic, I recommend that you check it out. But more importantly here, Steve is probably the best storyteller that I know in all of academia, and I mean that in the best possible way. Whereas storytelling might have an unfortunate negative connotation in some corners of the social sciences, you know, namely in the world of quantitative analysis. What I mean here is that Professor Pfaff is a great storehouse of historical and other empirical knowledge and is able to use that knowledge to bring a lot of abstract sociological theories to life. I should also note that Steve was the very first guest on this podcast series back in July of 2010 talking about the Protestant Reformation, and he now joins us for our 75th published interview. Steve, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So our format today is completely unstructured. I did draft up the initial introduction like I normally do. But from this point on, what I intend to do is bring up a series of different topics that have been in the news or been on the top of my head recently, or just get chat about them. In many ways, this is what we do in our offices every other week or so. And so it gives our listeners a chance to listen in on what we actually do here on the University of Washington campus when I stop at Steve's office and bug him every so often. So let me go ahead. And I want to start off with the topic of denominationalism. And this one I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm thinking about doing some research on it personally. And this relates back to a podcast that I had with Matt Boswell, who, by the way, is the pastor from my church. We talked to him a couple weeks ago about starting a church. And he did one basically after leaving another church. And one of the questions that came up was, are you going to affiliate with a denomination or not? And the general gist that I get from my different discussions with them says, no, we're not going to go it alone. So I started thinking, well, to what extent are denominations, such as the Missouri Synod Lutherans or the United Methodist Church or the Southern Baptist, to what extent are these denominations really useful for churches, or perhaps in this modern world they're becoming less relevant? So you know, I'm going to throw that out to you, Steve. To what denominations, what good are they?
Well, let's start a little bit with the example of Pastor Boswell.
Okay.
So, what are the so why might he be interested in shedding a denominational attachment, starting a new church, and intentionally not seeking out a new denominational attachment? So, it strikes me that one possibility, one advantage of non-denominationalism is pastoral autonomy. Especially if you have a very entrepreneurial pastor, I can see where a pastor like that might not wish to actually have to answer to anyone above him or her at the level of a bishop or a denominational authority or a superintendent. If these people, you know, if these clergy people are succeeding, they might say, I really don't need to have any disciplinary authority above me, and I don't really need to answer to someone above me. It might actually even just slow down or limit my freedom of action. Of course, another advantage too is you avoid revenue sharing, which can be a big advantage of not being affiliated. And some denominations actually require pretty substantial contribution to the denominational budget from individual churches.
Yeah, and that gets me to this question. This is one of the things that I was wondering over the past couple of years, and it's going to shift our focus a little bit here to not why somebody would want to not be affiliated with a denomination, but rather why you would be affiliated right. with a denomination. So most denominations work in that they go out and plant churches, and those churches are affiliated with the denomination, and they have to pay some kind of denominational dues, either a flat fee or sometimes it's based upon the amount of tithing they get, a percentage-wise. But the big question that came up for me is that if you're in one of these denominations, what do you get for that? And I mean, you're affiliated with a denomination, right?
Yes, I'm a member of a denominational church.
So what do you get out of a denomination? That's my big question.
You know, it strikes me that you get several things from it. One is branding.
Right.
And that can help with recruitment. For example, when I relocated to the Seattle area, I did what I think a lot of people with a strong denominational attachment do. I went church shopping, but I started in my own denomination and visited several churches in my own denomination and found one that I thought was outstanding. Now, we could pose a counterfactual. Had I found no church I thought was outstanding in my denomination, would I have sought out churches of in other denominations or nearby denominations, nearby in theological terms? And I think the way out is probably yes, because there were some churches that I had heard from people when I moved here that were very good, ones that had a good reputation. I did visit them and was often very impressed by the quality of the preaching or the order of service or what have you. So for some people, that branding matters. So it could be a tool for recruitment.
Yeah, I want to stop right there because this is what I've been thinking too. And historically, we have seen branding. And again, that term sounds very marketing. It sounds very economic. And I know some people will shudder when they hear that, say, oh, religion is very different than this. But it's really a basic signal to tell you what that church is about. I mean, it's familiar things. It's the hymns that you know, the theology that you know is very important. We talk about branding, say, for instance, for a McDonald's. When you visit a McDonald's in Boise, Idaho, or Birmingham, Alabama, you know what you're getting. It's going to be the same thing. It's the same thing if you go to a United Methodist Church in Georgia versus a United Methodist Church somewhere else, you're going to get roughly the same thing. There might be some differences in type of worship services they have or might sing slightly different songs or upbeat music and that, but it's going to be the United Methodist brand.
I agree. And by using the term branding, I don't mean to imply anything cynical about it. I don't really think it is cynical in that sense. I do think it helps people, especially during life transitions, for example, when they move, when they marry, when they have children, the moments in life when people are looking for a congregation, that's when, you know, in particular, that brand identity, as you say, that's the expectations that come along with that can be helpful to people. Because otherwise, if you just pull out the phone book and look under search on the internet and just look under churches, in any city of decent size, there's going to be hundreds of entries.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, it's going to be really tough. Where do you start? Some people never go through this, right? They go through it through interpersonal recruitment. Somebody they know says, this church is great and you should, or you're my best friend, want to come to church with me, or something like that. And in other people's cases where they don't have, and for example, in my case, where I didn't have strong social capital in the region, that familiarity with the denomination and what it has to offer helped a lot.
Yeah. And again, you used the term shopping for churches when you came here. Again, you were looking for a certain brand, but nonetheless, you're looking around in that. And, you know, a lot of times people maybe just go to the closest church near them. But, you know, in your case, as you said, you come from a very strong denominational background. So you were thinking about locating where you lived around where the church that you are. Happen to be. Yeah, that it does help to alleviate a lot of the uncertainty. When I go to a church that doesn't have a familiar brand name, it's just the Church of Fuzzy Slippers or something, you don't know what you're getting. And so you might not necessarily walk into that church. So
and you might be very pleasantly surprised, just like the same thing as if you're traveling on the interstate and you stop off at a local diner, it might be a much better meal than you would get at a familiar fast food chain, but it could be also a much worse meal. And so, you know, people knowing that tend to be more risk averse, and they're going to say, well, okay, let's take the thing we know and make sure we don't get at least a bad meal out of it.
Yeah, and with a meal, I mean, that's just if you have a bad meal, you move on. But
right.
with a church, you can make a big theological mistake sometimes, and that can really raise the stakes of your initial choice. What else might we get from denominations?
So what do I, you know, I'm an advocate for denomination. I don't think, I'm not saying every church has to be denominationally affiliated, but I guess I'd say I'm a defender of denominationalism, or at least I see that it has purposes. So besides branding, I think another advantage of denominationalism is discipline. And I mean that there's a clerical discipline imposed so that it prevents somebody making sure that there's no clerical malfeasance or no wandering too far afield from the basic doctrine, the basic Christian doctrines in this case, or whatever the religious doctrines
might
be.
You can't get goofy.
Yeah, it prevents sort of goofiness, right? So I think that has that good side on the disciplinary side. It can also offer a very rich collective or group identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if you take Lutherans in the United States, look, Garrison Keillor kind of goofs on Lutherans, right? But those jokes only work because for some listeners in some parts of the country, it's a recognizable enough group.
Right.
If he talks about what a Lutheran potluck supper is like, people know kind of what he means. And when he makes jokes about it or ribs them, they enjoy the ribbing because it hits home. They know that there's something to it. Likewise, their neighbors who are not Lutherans can laugh because they say, yeah, Lutherans do tend to be like that. Now, those are always, you know, generalizations, and I don't mean that they're they're very, you know, necessarily accurate descriptions. But what I'm getting at is that sometimes denomination comes with a strong group identity, which is sustaining to people and may also be faith-sustaining. That is to say, many times people over their life course, their faith goes through different seasons. Seasons of bloom, seasons of withering, and sometimes the reason you go or the reason you stay involved might be you feel strongly committed to the group. Sometimes that's because the group identity is strong, or sometimes it's because people rely on you, but that can help. And the other thing I think that denominations do when they're working well is they provide a kind of quality control.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be theological quality control, but also, for example, most denominations have affiliated seminaries or affiliated pastoral training of one kind or another. And I think that what that means is that you tend to know that the pastors you have are very familiar with gospel, with the Old Testament, with mm-hmm. basic theology. And that, I think, provides some basic quality control. There's at least that quality. And I remember one time my pastor made a really interesting point in which he said, part of my job as a pastor, and this reflects this kind of a strong denominational and confessional identity, he said, part of my job as a pastor is not just to bring the gospel to people, but to protect the gospel from people. That is to say, times change and people have different emphases or they want different things from the Bible. But for him, that there's an existing truth or that there's an enduring integrity to the gospel that means that we can't just treat it like duct tape that we use to fill in every hole or that we use to attach every two things together. And so he really felt that that was an important thing that his training, that his that denominational identity provided was a kind of way to make sure that there was a core message, a core idea about the gospel, a core understanding of mission that would remain more or less intact even as the church, as personnel come and go, pastors change, the membership changes.
Well, you're speaking of all of denominations here, so I'm going to kind of play the counter here and think about what might be a disadvantage of denominations. And as we mentioned before, it might be pretty costly. And I've been thinking about this recently because as I've been reaching out to different seminaries across the United States, telling them about this podcast, I've noticed a lot of seminaries, and this goes back to your training comment a minute ago, are really becoming more non-denominational, much more ecumenical. Is that, hey, if you're a Methodist, we have the seminary here. You're kind of used to be Presbyterian, but why don't you come on in and we'll train you as well. And you're seeing a lot more of that nowadays.
Mm.
And in terms of the training too, explosion in information technology, the cheapness of the availability of getting ideas makes it a lot easier for a small, independent, non-denominational church to get ideas about what they're going to do for sermons this week or what they're going to do for their summer vacation Bible school programs. And in many ways, there's a degree of consistency that you can get. You could go to Pastor Chuck Smith's website, and he has a variety of sermons that he's prepared on the different parts of the Bible, from the Old Testament all the way to Revelation. And you can just pick that stuff up. That's a lot cheaper than having to pay a big, huge fee for the denomination. So what would you say about that?
I think it's a really good point, and it reinforces a couple of the serious problems that denominational churches are facing right now. So one side about seminary education, which is typically denominational, an advantage of it is it tends to have very good systematic instruction.
Yeah, quality control, as you mentioned.
Right. The bad side of it is, as people like our own colleague James Wellman has shown some of his work, it often tends to select for people who are a little less entrepreneurial and more studious.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sometimes leads to a selection problem where you have people who are very studious and who have a lot of good qualities that may help them succeed in seminary, but then once they come into a position of congregational leadership, struggle. So I think that can be a problem. And sometimes some denominational seminary training is overly academic and doesn't focus enough on the practicalities of running a congregation, and a lot of that is organizational and financial. And also the absolute centrality of pastoral care.
Right.
And that is also not really theological. It doesn't come out of book learning. It comes out of, learning how to it's a kind of counseling skills.
Counseling, and also administrative.
Too. Administrative skills, right. So there's a bunch of skills which are often not very well trained, although some denominational seminaries are responding to these. They've come to realize this. That actually ill-prepare people for the actual challenges of congregational life. So that point I think is well taken. That's one problem. Another problem, and you hinted at this, I think, is especially the mainline denominations. This is not true of all denominations, but many of the mainline denominations seems like they've been doing everything they can to reduce their denominational distinctiveness, mm-hmm. Especially through the ecumenical movement.
Right.
And this has a huge disadvantage because then people could say, well, what's really the difference between, let's say, an Episcopal, a Lutheran, a United Methodist, a member of the Reformed Church, and so on. And if they're saying that, then why make the specific investment or why have the specific attachment to one or another of these denominations if these denominations are often emphasizing in the pulpit, in youth and adult education, in their publications, that they're not much different than these other ones, and that they should all be working together, that you can take communion in each other's churches, that they're in full harmony with each other, and so on. Well, part of what is the appeal of denominationalism is sort of undermined by that because the distinctiveness goes away. I mean, then you could even ask a second question. Why should I go to a lot of trouble of learning this particular catechism, like the Catechism of the Lutheran Church, when I've been told that these theological differences are not very important anyway?
And a lot of the theological differences, too, are somewhat obscure and really relate to people who are studying theology in a very specific academic kind of way. Because even myself, I would be hard-pressed to tell you the difference between a Methodist and a Baptist in terms of theology. Maybe the exception is Baptists tend to dance less, I guess. I mean, I don't know that very well. We say that with due respect to our Baptists because Baylor does sponsor this and they're associated with the Baptists. But so we say that in many lighthearted ways. But I think for a lot of people, especially amongst the mainline churches and maybe even across some of the more evangelical churches nowadays, especially a lot of these non-denominational churches, you don't really know the deep theology of this stuff. You want to go there for your Sunday religion. You want your Sunday sermon and you want to hear stuff. So, I'm wondering to what extent, denominationalism is really relevant nowadays for them.
I think that's right. I mean, for many contemporary religious believers, the theological differences that came out of the Reformation or the confessional age seem pretty trivial.
Yeah.
So slightly different interpretations of the Lord's Supper, for example, like the difference between a Zwinglian and a Lutheran interpretation, don't seem very relevant to most people. What used to be very bitter debates about infant versus adult baptism now probably seem – they just maybe people think the frontier of what really matters has moved on to other places. So that those kind of classic theological disagreements may seem a little less important. Now, to some extent, and this is true for Catholics as well, you know, part of why they're suffering that, or why people don't think that these theological differences matter much, is that in fairness, since the 60s, most denominations have actually de-emphasized actually teaching of their catechism,
right,
and the teaching of these theological differences. Maybe because there was some shift on the demand side, or maybe they just didn't supply it as much. So I know that even, you know, I was getting confirmed in the late 70s, early 80s, and we studied a lot more catechism and had a lot more religious instruction, and we learned actually what's the difference between this church and that church, and what are these theological differences. And I've noticed now that in the denomination to which I belong, that's not done very much anymore. That's almost vanished.
Yeah.
And I think that has mixed effects for denominations. On the one hand, they risk talking about a lot of antique stuff nobody cares about anymore. On the other hand, if people don't have part of what yields a strong denominational attachment is thinking we understand these things differently, maybe rightly, that we have a better way of worshiping or something like that. And if you really say, well, we don't have a better way of worshiping, we don't understand these things more rightly, and we're really no different than others, you've kind of undermined your own position.
You mentioned that in somewhat of a negative way, in that, well, we're downplaying these things, and so now people look at them as like, well, you Lutherans are the same as Methodists, so what's the big deal? I'll just go to the closest church to my house. But there might be some positive aspects to this. Let me run this by you, because this is a research topic that I'm running through my head now. Not only am I noticing a lot of non-denominational churches that are specifically non-denominational, that they don't have any affiliation with any denomination, they're going it alone, but there are a lot of denominational churches that downplay their denominational affiliation. A classic example of this is Rick Warren's Saddleback Church. If you go up to the average person who's heard of Saddleback, you say, okay, what denomination are they? And say, well, I don't know, they're Saddleback. But they're Baptist. And you would not necessarily know that. A long time ago, I went to a church out here by Issaquah, Washington, that was associated with the Free Methodist movement. I didn't know that for 2 years because there was no sign there. It was just, yeah, you know, the Timberlake Church. And, well, how would one know that? And so I'm kind of wondering if people are downplaying, or some of these churches are downplaying their denominational affiliation because they might not want to turn off the denominational shopper, or somebody who's grown up as a Methodist or has grown up as a Baptist, they move to somewhere else. And, you know, as a population, we're much more mobile than we used to be. And so you're looking for a church and, you know, you driving down the street and you say, oh, here's a Baptist church. Well, we're not Baptist because we used to be Methodist, or we're Presbyterian, so we don't go into that church. But if you cover up that part of the sign and you just say we're the community church, well, then, you know, okay, the church is a church. I feel more welcome into that church despite my past ancestors' denominational affiliations. What are your thoughts on that?
I think those points are really well taken. And, you know, we would also expect that different, you know, if I can use a term borrowed from economics, you know, if we think about different religious markets, not every religious market is the same in the United States. And in some regions of the country, you know, you have a lot of potential religious adherents who have very weak denominational attachment. In those regions, I would agree with you, any wise clergy person would de-emphasize, right, you know, in promoting the church would de-emphasize that, because those people don't have a strong built-in attachment to begin with. And it might just – the other thing is that I think sometimes denominational is associated with closed-mindedness –
rigid traditionalism,
yeah. And so, you know, by signaling that you're not captive, you know, to denominational identities or denominational loyalties or denominational discipline, you might also signal that you're forward thinking, autonomous, that you have there's room for this church to grow in new directions. And I think that's very appealing to people.
Yeah, and I think that's true. You mentioned how there's different regions of the countries that this might play a little bit better. We're up here in the Pacific Northwest, which is not a highly churched area. And it's also been a place that's seen a lot of in-migration, you know, from not only from other countries, but, you know, from people from California or from Montana have been moving out here. And these are the kind of people that are, you know, they pull up their roots and move. We want to find adventure. They don't have that necessarily the historical deep roots that many other people might have, say, in the deep south in the United States. And so that kind of thing might fly here as compared to somewhere else.
And sociology and religion have long noted that the West is a kind of laboratory for religious innovation, because people have in the West typically have experienced a lot of mobility, both social and geographical mobility, and have tended to have weaker attachments. And so there was a lot of chance for religious innovation, and I think that's true. And, and that, by the way, has been found. That's not just true for Christians; it's found for other religious traditions in the West as well.
Yeah.
So that there are weaker attachments to particular denominations of Judaism, or weaker attachments to certain schools of Asian religious thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a chance to recombine in interesting ways, or to innovate at the level of the congregation or the temple in the West that has been less available in other parts of the country where denominational attachments were stronger and there was less mobility. That said, it seems like that these trends are happening now across the United States. It's not just true in the West anymore.
Yeah, as we get more mobile. Well, let's finish off with one question on denominationalism. I want to move to a related question here. But here's my question for you, because early in this podcast series, we talked to Gordon Melton, who has done an amazing job of documenting churches throughout the United States and documenting the growth and decline of denominations. And in that podcast, which we'll link to, he made the argument that denominations are not going away. They're going to be a permanent fixture of the religious landscape here in the United States, not only in the near future, but probably, you know, for the next 100 years or so. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a very astute observation for a couple of reasons. One, even denominations whose the size of their membership is decreasing will probably not disappear.
Yeah.
In part because they have a lot of resources, you know, they have endowments and resources, and so even if they're shrinking, they're not likely to disappear. Another reason is because his perspective is quite right. In a dynamic religious marketplace like we have in the United States, there's a very good chance new denominations will emerge. And for example, if you look at a lot of non-denominational churches now, you could argue, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but you could argue there's a kind of quasi-denominationalism in formation. That is to say that even if they are not formally attached to each other, a lot of these pastors share best practices with each other.
Right.
A lot of them learn a lot from each other and are very avid in doing that. You mentioned before all the help that's available to help construct a good sermon and mm-hmm. so on that's available. And also a lot of them do still tend to group themselves generally along the lines of different levels of theological conservatism.
Yeah.
Now, it's quite – you know, Melton might be right. It's quite possible out of one of these formations a kind of new denomination emerges. It might not be the same or have the same structure. It might be more federated or something like that than the kind of mainline denominations that dominated the American religious landscape in the past. But those would still be something like denominations. Likewise, we shouldn't forget about non-Christian religious traditions in the United States. There's been some wonderful work that's shown how immigrant religion in the United States very quickly takes on a denominational form, even when the immigrants come from societies where religion was not denominationally organized. So that's very interesting. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that, you know, there might be different versions of Muslim denominationalism emerging, or Buddhist or Jewish. You
know. It makes sense in terms of what we were talking about, because when you're a stranger in a strange land, you need something to find familiarity with, eliminate a lot of the uncertainty that you have. And, you know, finding that quote-unquote brand name faith is very comforting and it's very helpful. Let me I just provoked one thing, so I'm gonna push on this topic a little bit more. We recently had a podcast with Mark Driscoll of Mars Hill Church, and Mars Hill has been involved in planting a number of churches around the United States, or around the Puget Sound region, but now they're starting to branch out into other states. And I'm almost thinking, and again, this is a very young church. It has a very young pastor, which is defined very young as that he's younger than me. And I mean, I almost wonder, is Mars Hill going to become a denomination? I mean, there's a lot of different branch locations, and, you know, invariably the pastor will pass from the scene at some point in time. And what happens to all these different churches? Do they become the Mars Hill denomination? What are your thoughts on that?
Now, that's a great question. And I mean, the Mars Hill and Pastor Driscoll are interesting in lots of regards. I mean, one possibility is the classic, the kind of classic moment that you allude to that the sociologist Max Weber talked about, and the crisis that often occurs in movements when the founder, the charismatic founder, has to be succeeded.
Right.
So what will happen then? You know, one possibility is that that Mars Hill will devolve to its franchisees, and the various franchise pastors will just each create their own autonomous church. That's a possibility. Another possibility could be they'd say, let's create some kind of federal structure. Mm-hmm. And a third possibility is they could try to be a really centralized organization. I doubt, centralization, but a federation is possible. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make a prediction in the case of any specific religion, so many things or religious group, anything could happen. But that's a nice example. And it's also an example of a clergy person who is very dynamic, who's very savvy in church building and church planting, and who maybe will have a package of theological interpretations, organizational skills, modes of church governance that lots of people want to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so a kind of denominational formation could not come from the top, but it could actually come from the bottom.
Yeah, it might. They have a program, I think it's called the Acts 29 movement. No, I'm getting that wrong. But it's a movement where they're actually training a lot of pastors to mimic the style that they have. And so it's partly a top-down, but it's also, go forth and be innovative. And a lot of these churches have a loose affiliation to Mars Hill, which is kind of intriguing.
And as, it's so interesting you mentioned go forth and be innovative. That's a tough message to give people because there's only so many ways to be innovative. And at a certain point in people's careers, it's as they tend to get older, as I know from experience, they tend to want to become – suddenly innovation seems a little bit more threatening and a little less
– It's tiring
less,
to do.
Less, less exciting than it did when you're in your 20s, early 30s. So it could be that they innovate themselves out at some point, right? They've kind of explored all they can explore and for various reasons want a little bit more stability and predictability, and that's traditionally been one of the advantages of some kind of denominational alliance or affiliation.
Now, we talked about branding before, and one of the reasons why we have denominational brands is because it helps to provide a degree of quality control. And you want to keep your theological message on track and consistent with across this. I'm going to shift gears a little bit. It's somewhat related to this question, but I want to link to this article by Rabbi Eric Yaffe. I found this on Real Clear Religion, and I should note that Real Clear Religion has actually put us on their blog roll, and we thank the folks who are out there doing that. We appreciate the traffic they're driving our way. But it was a couple days ago, and we'll link to this. Rabbi Eric Yaffe had an article on the Huffington Post that Real Clear Religion linked to, and he wrote that American religion doesn't really seem to talk much about sin anymore. And this is connected with this concern that, our churches are not becoming branded anymore. It's not the old fire and brimstone that we used to know, that you have these mega churches that seem to go on their own and they provide a very fluffy bunny slippers type of religion to individuals. Is that really true?
This is mostly impressionistic. I don't really have good social science evidence to back up my views on this, although I will talk a little bit about some recent empirical work. It strikes me that he's onto something.
And I got to stop a minute because this is one of the great things that in going to your office and we're talking around and Steve is very humble this way. He says, I don't really know much about this. But then you pull out your 15 different sources that you read and it's like, man, you have all this knowledge in front of you, Steve. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, I hope that's true. I hope that's true in this case. I think he has a point about discussion of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just – I think it's very unfair to lay that only at the doors of non-denominational religion or new trends in Christianity. I think that's really unfair because I think that a lot of mainline churches are also having a hard time talking about sin.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is in the United States we've experienced really rapid cultural and social change. I mean, look at how quickly attitudes have shifted on subjects like divorce in the United States.
Right, and big shift in the 1970s, yep.
Right, so going back to the 1970s. More recently, a big shift on attitudes towards homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
These are really momentous shifts. And I think it's made it hard for a lot of besides all that, another trend, sort of macro trend, is increasing religious and cultural pluralism in the United States. I mean, the U.S. religious field keeps getting more diverse. And our culture keeps getting more plural, in part because of immigration, but also part because of differentiation within the existing within the existing culture.
And to live in a tolerant society, or at least to live in this very pluralistic society, it becomes necessary to become a lot more tolerant. Otherwise, you get a lot of civil conflict, right?
Exactly. And Rodney Starrs has written, I think, very eloquently on this point, that what tends to breed religious civility, and that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody thinks that every other's religion is just as right as theirs, but civility, which means, for example, in public, not calling the other guy a sinner and doomed to perdition and so on, part of what breeds civility is exactly diversity. It's exactly having to operate in a very, very diverse landscape and being cautious about others' feelings, but also being cautious about overstating your own authority and so on. So it's not just non-denominational churches. I think that it's become harder for all Americans of all different religious traditions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, to talk about sin, mm-hmm. or at least to reserve sin, the talk of sin, for only things that there's a lot of consensus are really bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, with some traditional theology, lots of things might be routinely talked about as sin. So he has a point there. It has potentially it involves some pitfalls, I think, for religious groups. One is, we've talked a little bit about why some denominations might be slipping, or why some denominations are struggling, or why some people don't want to be involved with the denomination. One of the things we talked about was distinctiveness. Mm-hmm. One of the things that yields distinctiveness is having a certain degree of moral tension with moral tension with the society around you.
Yeah.
And if we're afraid to talk about sin, we may also be reducing the moral tension with the rest of society.
Yeah, everybody's cool. Whatever you want to do, that's fine. And so if you give that message of whatever you want to do is fine, then people go, great, whatever I want to do is fine. I don't want to come to church anymore. I just kind of want to sit home and drink beer and watch football.
And if we have a message that says basically everyone's a good person, yeah. and most actions are basically fine so long as they don't directly hurt somebody else, it may be a pragmatic kind of morality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly Judeo-Christian Islamic morality, mm-hmm. which have clear understandings of what's sinful and what's not sinful, and how. But not just on the denunciation side. And this is why I take it another step. The thing about that's so important about talking about sin in these religious traditions is not just that you get to denounce other people or feel badly about yourself and so on, although those moments can be important. It's because sin is always attached to an argument about repentance, about transformation of the mm-hmm. individual, about mm-hmm. transformation of the individual. And so if we're creating religions that help people feel great about how they are, where they are, with no transformation moment, no repentance moment.
Yeah, you don't need that redemption. If I'm okay, you're okay.
Yeah, and I think exactly. And that, I think, not only makes then religion seem kind of wishy-washy or what's the point, mm-hmm. it also makes it very easy for people who are not religiously affiliated but who aspire to be moral people to say, I can be moral without religion.
Mm-hmm.
And in the terms of the terms of discussion that the religious groups themselves have fostered, they're right.
Yeah.
So there's a point. If you give up sin, then you talk less about repentance. If you talk about less about repentance, you undermine part of what is so important about religion to the individual.
Yeah.
So I think he's got a point there. And Christian Smith, in a wonderful new book on that's studying how young people make the transition from adolescence to adulthood, has some really distressing findings in this regard, and finds that one of the things that should be most helpful for young people making this transition should be their religious attachments. And he finds that whether or not they're involved in more strict or more liberal religious groups doesn't seem to matter very much. Young people are not talking much about sin. And moreover, they're not using religion much to talk about the moral challenges that they face or the moral expectations that come with adulthood.
I mean, I haven't had a chance to read Christian's book, and we probably should get him on a podcast here. But hasn't that always been true of youth? And I'm kind of concerned you know, whether or not he's doing this in a time series analysis, if we had good data in the 1950s, were teens much more concerned about sin back then, or, you know, were they, I mean, for me, it seems like a teenager today is probably just like a teenager 40, 50 years ago. So, I mean, what would he have to say about that, or what's your thoughts on that?
And that's a really good point. And I mean, his data are longitudinal, but they're only over a few years during this, you know, he follows people during this transition, yeah. But he can't tell us, I don't think. You know, whether they're substantially different than kids were in the 70s or the 60s or the 40s or the 30s or something like that. And I think your point is, your skepticism is well placed because, you know, every generation tends to think that the generation coming up is, you know, sort of immoral or...
Kids, they don't have it tough like
exactly.
I did.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm arguing against, you know, I'm providing evidence against my own previous argument.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what we do here. That's what the University of Washington and social science is all about.
That's right. One thing is, if you know, some trends are actually very encouraging about young people today. For example... Out of wedlock pregnancy is down, and kids seem to be much more savvy about drug and alcohol experimentation. It's not that it's not happening or that's not happening young, but you know, a lot of evidence shows that kids are more aware of what they're doing. They're more aware of the dangers and pitfalls around early drug alcohol initiation. So in that sense, you know, one could argue the kids are all right. Things are not so bad in that regard. So. In terms of the sort of sociological ramifications of this, I can't give a, you know, you're right, I can't give a really good picture and say things have changed that much. I guess what I was really speaking about was two different, slightly different issues about the culture, public culture, and about how well religious groups navigate their way through a changing public culture. So for me, if you give up talking too much about, I mean, I don't think it's obsessive discussion of sin and denouncing others as sinful, that I'm not talking about that at all. But if you give up completely on the idea of sin, I'm afraid you also give in to a kind of utilitarian morality, which is just at odds with a lot of what religious people otherwise say that they value or believe in or something like that. And they also then are doing something which is contradicts one of the values they claim, which is that their morality is not an invented morality or just a pragmatic one that shifts with the times. That it may shift or it may adapt, but it ultimately has a divine inspiration, and that is prior to prior to changes in human culture and human social organization. So, you know, if they give up that too much, they're also sort of thwarting themselves in a way, right? They want to say there's something transhistorical about their message, and sin has to be, I think, should be part of that. The other issue is the repentance issue, and if religious groups want to be part of the solution for people in their everyday life, help their families work better, help their relationships work better, help them feel better about themselves, help them come closer to God, help them live in ways that they think are God-pleasing, then they have to be able to say something about repentance and that there are clearly better and worse routes in life, and some of those will bring you closer to the divine, and some will alienate you from the divine.
Well, here's the thing. When I read the piece by Rabbi Eric Yaffe, I thought, well, I mean, is he missing some other things that are going on here, contemporary period time? Oftentimes, we tend to look around our immediate surroundings, and if we're in a liberal denomination that has been de-emphasizing sin recently, we think that everybody is doing that. And in that regard, I again thought about Driscoll's church here in the Pacific Northwest, is that you go to one of Mark Driscoll's church, you get punched in the face big time with sin, that yes. You are a sinner in a big way. My own church, we get that. That's, you know, you're a sinner, and just accept that fact, and now let's start moving on to redemption and start thinking about what all that means. And so I see pockets of this around, and even
I think
in some
of the reasons why those churches are actually doing well.
Doing well, yeah. And that's surprising because one of the things that when I interviewed Driscoll, I was quite amazed to find out that he's attracting a lot of young single males in their 20s. I'm like, wow, that is not the churchy population. That's not the people who you see in the pews on Sundays. So, and he's doing it with a very much in your face, you're a sinner, straighten up so you can get saved type of approach. Even in some of the bigger mega churches, and we've had a couple podcasts previously on mega churches here, we'll link to those, that seem fluffy on the outside. You know, they're very inviting. Come on in. Everybody's welcome. If you want to wear your bunny slippers in, that's cool. We'll give you a latte. And you try to have the slick music and the cool, and you make it a big event. But as you get deeper into these churches, as you become a member, you know, there's a point that they say, okay, you're welcomed in here, but now here's the real core message. It is about sin. And man, you know, the message we're going to come by is going to be pretty heavy. And you know, but again, you can't necessarily bring somebody in the door of their argument that way by calling, here, you are a sinner. You better get in here. Say, hey, we got something that might interest you. Why don't you stop in? So that's one thing. That's in the contemporary period. Are we missing a lot of things, missing a lot of dynamics that are new that we don't see? And then also historically. Because when Rabbi Eric Yaffe made this argument that we've become too soft, we've stopped talking about sin, he pitches it as a more contemporaneous thing. But I can't help thinking about, well, the Pentecostal movement back in the early part of the 20th century, this was their same complaint. All these religions have gotten very light and fluffy. The Second Great Awakening in the early 1800s, same thing. You've yes. gotten away from the faith. First Great Awakening, wow, you guys were puritanical in the 1600s, and now you're just routine. It just seems to be – well, even go back to Luther or right. to a lot of the various schismatic movements within the Catholic Church throughout its entire history, saying, no, you guys getting away from the true faith. You're not talking about the core things anymore, so we're going to come out and talk to these core things. So, you know, are we missing things historically? Are we missing things contemporaneously in these different pockets? What?
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, that these historical episodes of secularization, revival, and reformation, which has happened not just in the Christian tradition, but has happened in other religious traditions too. This tends to be driven. It's often a debate about sin and about whether people become too worldly and have gotten too far away from God and have become too accepting, tolerant. So, for example, one of the arguments is that some Islamic reform movements were affiliated with that, feeling that the original morality of the religion has been corrupted by urbanism, soft living, accommodations with other religions, and so on, and that these are sinful malformations, and that the way to revive the religion is to
purify it,
yeah. and repent, and so on. And certainly, we see that in Calvin for sure, Luther. You know, they're very much present. Now, different religions will have different arguments about how you achieve that repentance or something like that. So I think those points are well taken. I mean, we shouldn't have an ahistorical view and think that this moment is unique in that sense. And it may be that a kind of overly relativistic or overly amoral public culture is leading to exactly the kind of reaction you're talking about. And maybe mm-hmm. we'll see some church. You know, we do seem to see some theologically strict churches doing really well, attracting a lot of followers.
And that's the dialogue that they often use, right? That all these other churches have gone soft. They stopped talking about sin, so we're bringing sin back in.
Now that's one of the things that strikes me from reading sermons from different religious Christian denominations. And this is something that comes up in our colleague Jim Wellman's study of churches in the Pacific Northwest too, is that part of the issue is not just unwillingness to talk about sin. It's an emphasis on different sins or identification of sin in different places and different kinds of mm-hmm. behaviors. So for example, in a lot of liberal denominational churches, you'll hear a lot of talk about the sin of environmental destruction, that's a failure to be good stewards, and that's a sin. That's a violation of God's will for people. Or you might hear about the sin of warfare and militarism,
or economic injustice.
Yeah, or economic social injustice, yeah. right, and so on. So you know, there's a willingness to talk about sin, but then not so much talking about at the individual level sins and that kind of thing as much, or about personal immorality. And then I noticed that in some of the more theologically conservative sermons that I've read, there's a big emphasis on stuff that relates to family life. There's a big emphasis on family life. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Pastor Driscoll, there's a lot on the appeal to the young men you've talked about before is, are you ready to be – has sin pulled you away so that you can't be a good husband, you can't be a good father, or that you haven't prepared yourself for marriage and so on, that you're not and sometimes even he uses the language, you haven't really grown up. You know, you're still mm-hmm. acting like an adolescent, even mm-hmm. though you're here in your 20s or your 30s or something like that. So – it's not just that people aren't willing to talk about sin. It's that it's remarkable how different people's interpretation of what the primary sins are or where sin is located, the main axis where sin should be located. And it's probably inevitable that in a really diverse religious culture like ours, that that will happen, that it's not just that people don't talk about sin, it's that it's located in different places.
Right, right.
And where – what sins have to be addressed first? I mean, people have to – I guess people feel they have to prioritize someplace. And where – what sins do we go after first? So I bet a lot of young people in more liberal mainstream denominations are very – like if you were to survey them, they probably have very high awareness of things like environmental degradation or climate change issues or cruelty to animals or a bunch of those kind of – which are also ethical, moral issues as well. And then there might be more emphasis on what's pulling families apart or what's sexual immorality or something like that in the more conservative ones.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as we're talking about this is you talk about the marketplace that we have here and the pluralism that we have in the United States. It's oftentimes seen as in a negative light. But, you know, as we talk about this, different churches are reacting in different ways to this. It becomes a dialogue amongst different churches, and you get so many different views on this thing. I actually consider it to be a fairly big strength. And it's we live in a landscape. We live on a landscape that is constantly innovating and remaking itself, and not in ways that it's always getting away from the core religious values, but, you know, that oftentimes say, let's get back to the core religious values. I find it a very great strength. I know a lot of pastors worry about it. So many people are deviating from that. But that gives other people a chance to speak their mind and get other people back to what their faith is. So, I mean, there's a benefit of that. Because if you only had one church and it deviated from the norm and nobody else could, you know, say anything against it, well, that's what you're stuck with, folks.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think one of the things that's related to the vitality of American religious life is its diversity, the many different interpretations of the road to salvation that are available, the many different ways there are to build a church, a temple, or other religious community. These have to be regarded as great strengths. And I think in comparative terms, one of the great moments of institutional genius in the United States, the non-establishment clause and the providing enormous religious liberties to newcomers, both innovators but also immigrants, to give them enormous religious liberties is just one of the great things about the United States. And you know, this is debated in the science of it, but I think probably helps to account for why religious life is far more diverse and more active, and people are more attached to religion, think it matters more for their lives in the United States than most other, you know, in advanced industrial countries. I think it really does help to explain. If America, you know, I'm not a big believer in these arguments about American exceptionalism, but if there's one variable in which we really differ from other advanced industrial democracies, it's in this one, that we have this kind of religiosity, which is made possible, I'd argue, largely because of it's so free and so little regulated and so on. And I think that's been great not only for developing all these different kinds of religious goods that are available to people, but also for creating the religious civility we talked about before, right? I think we actually are pretty religiously civil. There's occasional friction, you know, especially groups that are close to each other and competing for the same niche, you know, often rub up against each other. But
you got 300 million plus people of a lot of different views. There's going to be some weirdness every so often.
Given that, there's extraordinary religious civility in the United States.
Yeah.
And most people have an extraordinary live and let live attitude towards religions, even religions that they think are much more conservative than theirs, more liberal than theirs, that are culturally different than theirs, that seems strange, whatever. That's huge civility. All right. All of this comes at a cost, or at least imposes a tension, which has to do, I think, with this issue we've been talking about. And the issue is this. A lot of Americans also, and a lot of people of faith especially, would also yearn for a more unified public culture, a more unified public culture in which values associated with faith and forms of social life that are affiliated with faith had greater prominence, mm-hmm. or played a greater role in determining the national conscience. And there are plenty of initiatives to try to do that, and you can even see jostling within the political parties. There are candidates who, you know, evoke this idea that we should have a more unified public culture, or that we should truly be a religious, you know, religious culture or a Christian democracy, or whatever those arguments are. All that reflects, I think, a real desire, and it's not just found among conservatives. I think people of a lot of religious stripes feel this too. They would like it if we had a more unified public culture. They say to themselves, Should we really have a public culture? Do I really want a public culture like this where there's so much, let's say, pornography available, or there's so much violence on television, or there's so much family dissolution, or there's so many neglected children, or we don't always have a clear moral story to tell kids about themselves and who they are and where they came from and where they're going. We want all of that. Where we accomplish it best tends to be at the level of our congregations or, you know, in our families. And where we accomplish it less well is at the level of the public culture or the public discourse. My argument would be that's an inevitable tension and probably a worthwhile tension to have on the other side, the degree of freedom, liberty, pluralism that we have.
Well, it is good in that way. And then you say this is a worthwhile tension to have, and there's a trade-off with the freedoms that we need. I see it as a very positive freedom in that we are constantly challenging ourselves about that public culture. And, you know, one of the interesting things about politicians making appeals to a public culture is that it resonates. It's usually in very amorphous, broad terms. But then that resonates with different smaller communities saying, yeah, that's kind of what we want. We interpret it this way. We interpret it that way. But nonetheless, we're working in many ways for the same purpose, but in a lot of different ways that can create conflict, which is ironic.
I think another source of conflict that we have today, but this actually goes back even to the 19-teens and the birth of fundamentalism and Pentecostalism, that era of religious change you talked about before. You know, another book by Christian Smith, which is quite good on this, is his book, The Secular Revolution. And he makes a pretty provocative argument there, which is that America secularized in terms of the reducing the influence of religious authorities on the universities, on the public schools, in publishing, in a host of really important sectors of American life. That happened very rapidly, mm-hmm. and it happened largely because of elite secularization. It was pretty much an elite-led process.
Right.
I feel that he's gone to something there, and I see the same tension today. Part of the tension, and part of this is this unease in the public culture, is partly because sometimes elites are moving faster than the rest of the public. Now, that's sometimes good because sometimes leadership is needed, and sometimes we stick with bad practices, segregation, sexual discrimination, because their habits are conventional or they meet our prejudices. And sometimes we really admire those leaders who push us beyond those and say, that time has ended, it's over. On the other hand, I'm not saying there's no role for leadership or even moral leadership by elites. On the other hand, there's a little bit of carelessness by elites. And I think that there's sometimes a moving of the frontier of public culture and public morality that's being pushed faster at the level of elite-controlled institutions than many of the people who are governed by those institutions or operate within them are comfortable with.
And it often has a dismissive attitude toward the people who that are the followers in that regard. And it's just let's jettison tradition because tradition must be wrong.
Yeah, that these people are reactionary, backward, bigoted, or whatever. Now, some objections to social change or some objections to new legislation or new directions, yeah, some of them are bigoted. But to say that all are bigoted, to say that, you know, not only is wrong, it's extremely counterproductive and produces exactly more of the kind of political, cultural, moral tension that makes the public culture so, you know, sometimes seem so fractured and so unhealthy and makes people despair. So, you know, it's hard, but, you know, just as in religious life, we do best when we have some space for civility and allow that there's going to be differences, and these differences not only won't disappear but don't need to disappear and actually can help make the overall religious field thrive. You know, we might also think about that a little bit more. I wish we would think about that more in our public culture as well.
Yeah. Well, that actually might be a good place to stop here. We had a whole mess of topics written down, but as you can see, when Steve and I get going on this, our minds wander quite a bit and we dip into a number of other different things. We keep dipping into Christian Smith, so he should be thanking us for promoting all his books. But I do want to remind you to check out our website so you can check out Steve Pfaff's book. He's written a number of different interesting articles as well as his book on exit dynamics and what was it called? Exit Voice Dynamics and the Collapse of East Germany. We'll link that for you.
And available as an ebook.
It's available as an ebook for you now too. Are you an ebook reader?
Actually, I don't have an ebook reading device,
okay.
But I've come around to recognizing that these are wonderful things for a number of reasons. It makes it easier for people to read in some settings, people with compromised eyesight to read. I really appreciate that. Yeah. And the cost. Yeah. You know, so I think my book is around $24 as a paperback, but it's cost a lot less as an ebook, and I'm very pleased that my publisher, Duke University Press, has made it available that way, because if it falls into more people's hands in that way, I'm very pleased.
Yeah, well, I should note, too, that my book is available as an ebook. Since we promoted Christian Smith's two of his books, we need to promote our own. So we'll link to all of those on the website. And again, I just want to remind folks that this podcast is a really great deal, because Baylor University, the Institute for Studies of Religion, is helping us to make this free and available to the public. So if you've liked what you've heard here, if you like listening in to a conversation on two academics, let us know, because we might do this more often. I really have a great deal of time, or a great great fun time talking with Steve all the time. And I sit there and I said, man, I should just have a microphone in on some of these. And now I have the ability to do it. So if you like what you heard today, please let us know, and please pass the word to your friends. So, Steve, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Well, thanks for giving me an opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.